St. Mark's. Peter thought about how different high school would have been if he'd been able to look across a room and find her there. If he had her walking alongside him, everywhere he went. They drank like they were getting paid, as Kate always put it. Everything from Bud Lights to Zimas to boxed wine to whiskey to vodka to rum. I hate rum, Peter observed one night as he was pouring some into his cup. Everyone laughed. To anyone who asked where he and Kate met, they said only that they grew up together. High school sweethearts, people said, and they issued no corrections. And then, almost no sooner than he felt he'd gotten the hang of college, had gotten the hang of navigating the lower intestines of the Port Authority bus tunnel to the subway that would bring him closest to Kate's dorm, no sooner, or so it felt, than he had really started to like his life and feel like he was not living for the future or the past, people started asking him what he was going to do next, what he was going to be. He majored in history, and his advisor was the first to bring it up. Then George, who told Peter he was welcome to come back and live with him for as long as he needed. He'd gotten a new apartment with his girlfriend, Rosaline. But it was a two-bedroom, and there was plenty of room for Peter if he needed time to get on his feet. It was just around the corner from George's old apartment. Peter had stayed there for several weeks over the summer before senior year. It was clean and beige and had knick-knacks and potted plants and bore absolutely no traces of George, unless Peter counted the bits of stubble coating the sink every morning. George's girlfriend called Peter separately one night to reiterate the offer, in case Peter thought it was just George being overly generous. "You've been through a lot," Rosaline said, and Peter felt the slow burn of embarrassment push up from his throat to his cheeks. Of course George would have told her everything. Of course. He didn't mind. It had just caught him up short.
"Oh, and Peter?" Rosaline said. "I'm throwing a birthday party for George. Would be fun if you could come. He said he thinks you might be seeing someone, that you're being shy about it. Bring her, too, if you like. He's turning 37, and he's depressed about it. We're just going to have a little dinner at the Thai place he likes."
"Sorry, did you say 37?
Peter did a quick calculation. But that meant George had only been 29 when he and his father moved in so suddenly. He knew George was a decade younger than his father, but Coach was 40 and seemed younger than George. When Peter thought about it, most of his professors were probably older than 40 and all seemed younger than George.
I know, right? He's been through a lot, too."
Peter majored in history, but majors didn't seem to matter as much as he expected them to when it came to getting a job. English majors were going to law school. Philosophy majors were also pre-med. Going to med school was out for Peter because he hadn't taken the prerequisites. Finance didn't interest him. Plus, there was a towel-snapping vibe in any econ seminar he'd taken that reminded him of the locker room at Dutch Kills. Accounting was too boring. What else could a person be? A teacher, maybe? There was a job fair in December of senior year, and Peter ambled through, looking at booths. Marketing, advertising, consulting, healthcare, hospitality, insurance, childcare, Department of Corrections, Department of Transportation. Starbucks had a booth. Sears. The local utility company. The Adventure Aquarium in Camden. They all had shiny posters and bowls of candy and smiling representatives. Every job was located in either New Jersey or New York and made him feel like a butterfly pinned to a board. There was a whole country to explore. He'd just finished a biography of Steve Prefontaine and had been wondering about Oregon, also Colorado, California. Sometimes, in his dreams, he asked his mother questions that she refused to answer. Sometimes, also in his dreams, he brought her his college transcript, like a kindergartner eager to show off his gold stars, and she let it slide to the cold linoleum floor without even looking. Recently, in his waking life, on his way to a track meet in Syracuse, the van had pulled off in Albany so the team could eat and pee and stretch, and Peter felt himself looking around, furtively, as if he might be spotted in the area. While the team finished eating, he went to the rest stop lobby to stare at a map of the city,
all the broken lines that indicated routes in and out. He didn't tell Kate about George's birthday party, and he told himself that was because he could only barely make it himself. He'd mentioned Kate to George, just once, telling him only that he'd met up with her for drinks, and George looked completely confounded, asked why in the world Peter had seen her, that it seemed like opening a whole can of worms. Is she the type who stirs up old drama? Or maybe, do you think her father put her up to it? Maybe thinking of a civil suit? George asked. He was still in the old apartment at the time, and they were trying to fix the air conditioner. The condensation had leaked inside and warped the parquet floor. George was lying on his back, staring at the unit from underneath.
No, she's not a dramatic type, Peter said, and let it go.
Kate cut off the dip-dyed ends of her hair, removed the polish from her nails, and interviewed for a criminalist position with the NYPD. She got an offer on the spot. She'd considered engineering. She thought about biochemistry. She even considered something in agriculture for a week or two before she realized how few of those jobs were in New York. The day she walked into the crime lab in Jamaica for her interview, wearing an ugly brown suit that had been handed down from Natalie to Sarah and then to Kate, she told Peter it had felt like home. It can be a culture shock, Dr. Lehrer said when he invited her to sit down among the microscopes and Bunsen burners. But she'd grown up in the culture. She spoke the language. Peter felt a twinge of envy that she could be so sure. Even the choices she struggled with were in the same category. She knew what she wanted and had homed in on it. One day Peter thought he'd like to be a track coach, and the next day he thought he should go to graduate school and become a college professor. And I accept it. I start June 1st.
In New York?
Yes, the lab in Queens.
You already accepted?
Yes. Why? You don't sound happy for me.
No, I am. But that means we'll be staying in New York.
Well, yes. Were you thinking somewhere else? They'd never discussed what would happen once college was over. They both assumed, correctly, that the other wanted to be nearer, that they would see each other more often.
I don't know. I was thinking of maybe you and me together in a place where we don't know anyone.
Oh, Kate said, confusion plain in her voice. Why would we want to be in a place where we don't know anyone? But Peter couldn't say why, because he didn't know. Sometimes he thought of himself hiking in unfamiliar terrain, reaching a summit and not recognizing any of the landmarks below. The feeling was exhilarating. Their graduations fell on the same day, and both were relieved that they could put off facing each other's families for just a little longer. George and Rosaline came to see Peter graduate, and after the ceremony, when his friends and teammates were going out for one last round of parties, Peter told them all that he'd made plans with his uncle and would catch them soon. He told George and Rosaline that he was going out with his friends so they could have a nice lunch on their own. Instead, he walked 2 miles along the country road to a towny bar where he planned on sitting alone all afternoon and watching the Yankee game. On the way there, he passed an abandoned lemonade stand. A Fisher-Price register toppled over in the grass, $1 bill still in the drawer. Peter moved in with George and Rosaline for the summer, and shaped for shifts with the iron workers while he figured out what he should do.
It's just temporary, he must have said a dozen times around the apartment that first weekend,
because eventually Rosaline put her cool hand on his arm and told him to please not worry about it. His bedroom there smelled like potpourri and gave him a headache, even after he covered the bowl with a towel and placed it at the bottom of the narrow closet. George seemed more confused than disappointed that Peter had graduated without a plan. He said he liked the company when they hurried to his truck every morning, their lunchboxes in hand, but he would ask Peter to talk about the business classes he'd taken in college, as if to remind him of where his head should be. On his first day back with the Ironmen, Peter looked around for his old friends. After a few days went by, he asked for them. The guy he asked seemed surprised that Peter didn't already know that John Salvatore had gotten badly injured and probably wouldn't work again.
Peter wondered if he ever bought that house he'd had his eye on, if he'd ever married his girl. Turned out Jimmy McRee was there working beside Peter all week, only Peter hadn't recognized him. He'd put on a lot of weight, and his face was weather-beaten, haggard. He looked 10 years older than Peter. Peter reintroduced himself one morning, reminded Jimmy that last time they spoke he was saving for a Camaro.
"Yeah, I remember you," Jimmy said. "The boss's son."
"No, not his son, his nephew."
"Let me ask you this, nephew. How many days did you have to shape before they let you on? I got a cousin. He's been out there for weeks. He has a newborn at home. My brother shaped for a month before he got a day."
Peter had done exactly what George told him to do. He'd lined up at the gate, and when they called his name, he'd step forward.
"Sorry,"
Peter said, though he wasn't sure what he was apologizing for. He'd make over 300 bucks that day, before taxes, and he needed the money badly. He couldn't stay in George's potpourri-infused room forever. Jimmy snickered, but there was no joy in it. His teeth were sharp and stripped with brown and reminded Peter of a jackal. George finally met Kate on the last day of August 1999, on the day she moved off campus, where she'd gotten free summer housing thanks to a tutoring job, and into an apartment she'd share with a few girlfriends. Peter had hoped they'd be living together by the fall, but he still didn't know what he wanted to do, and a few of his teammates from Elliott were going in on a shitty apartment on Amsterdam and 103rd, so he agreed to live with them. It was Kate who told him to stay with his friends, have fun. Between all of them, the rent would be pretty cheap. But Peter suspected she also wanted him to get a place without her, because she didn't have the courage to face her parents. She told her father they were seeing each other years earlier, in a fit of fury, but as far as Peter could tell, they'd never discussed it again. And Francis must not have told Kate's sisters, because once, when Peter and Kate were juniors, he was staying with her at NYU for the weekend, when Sarah stopped by unannounced. "I brought you a burrito," she said, when Kate opened the door, and then she looked past Kate and saw Peter, who was sitting at Kate's desk in mesh shorts and t-shirt. It was early November, and Sarah had just started a job on Bleecker Street, not far from Kate's dorm.
"Holy shit," she said, visibly pale as she handed the takeout bag to Kate,
and without another word, she turned and left. Natalie called within the hour. Kate recognized her number on the caller ID and shrugged.
"Better face the music," she said to Peter, and picked up.
She ushered him out of her room. "Get lost for an hour, will you?" she said, and leaned up to kiss him. When he returned, it was obvious she'd been crying, but she assured him it was fine, they were fine, it would all be fine. After that, listening to Kate's end-of-phone conversations with her sisters, he could tell that they asked about him, but Kate always kept it light. Peter, for his part, was not all that eager to see Natalie and Sarah, but if Kate wanted him to spend time with them, then he would, and it would be okay. The person he most dreaded seeing was Francis Gleason, and he'd surely have to if they moved in together. When he discovered that Kate was looking into renting a U-Haul van, Peter offered up George's truck, which he was sure he could borrow for a few hours on a Saturday. George didn't mind Peter borrowing the truck, but he did mind Peter driving it. Peter had gotten his driver's license in his senior year of college, and only then, because his buddy on the track team had a little hatchback he kept at school, and said Peter could borrow once in a while if he wanted to see Kate in New York without dealing with the bus.
"For who, did you say? You need the truck to help who?"
George asked. He'd promised Rosaline a set of shelves above the television, and he'd just returned from the hardware store with two long pieces of oak, a pair of brackets. When Peter said Kate's name, he could see the astonishment in George's face.
"Of all the fish in the sea, Peter? Weren't there pretty girls at college?"
He put the wood down, dropped the plastic hardware store bag on top. He screwed up his face like it was a physical process, a painful process, making sense of something that came as a surprise.
"Yes,"
Peter said simply. George nodded, gave the information a moment to breathe. He walked to the kitchen sink, and keeping his back to Peter, he poured a glass of water, drank it.
"I don't like it. Something about it."
"I know."
It's just trouble. For no reason, you know?
I know.
This girl, that girl, literally any other girl, and it wouldn't matter. There's just one girl in the world who seems like a bad idea, and it's this one.
But why is it a bad idea?
There. He said it. His father had left. His mother was gone. And so, who would object? Her parents, probably, but that was for her to handle. And if he had a chance to speak to them, he felt certain he could convince them to come around. And if they didn't come around, well, that was their problem. He and Kate had never done anything wrong. He was very sorry about what his mother had done, but surely Mr. Gleason couldn't really think any of it was Peter's fault.
Because... George struggled but was determined. Because it means all that stuff from years ago, it didn't end back then. It's still happening.
Well, no, Peter thought, but he didn't want to argue. Everything that happened had happened to their parents. Or at least, their parents were the agents of all that had happened. Or at least, their parents were the ones who could have stopped it from happening. Or... He got that choked-off feeling he always got whenever he thought about that night. If he'd never suggested to Kate that they should sneak out. If they hadn't been caught. One thing leads to another, which leads to another, yes. But who could have predicted that last fallen domino would skid so far from the neatly toppled row? Not the pair of teenagers, that was for sure. When he and Kate started seeing each other again, they decided that they'd leave all that baggage behind and start fresh. He was old enough now to know what sustained him, and so was Kate. They were apart long enough to know the shape of each other's absence.
Well, all I know is this is the girl. I love her.
George flipped the faucet on again with a flick of his wrist, refilled his glass. He gulped the water down like he'd been in the desert for weeks.
You're stubborn, Peter. You're a great kid, but you're stubborn.
I'm not a kid, Peter said, though saying so made him feel like a kid.
You love her. Okay. It's a strong feeling, but think about it all the way through. What's next? You gonna marry this girl? Have kids with her? Your mother and Francis Gleason are going to have the same grandbabies? They're going to sit at the same table at the christening?
Huh?
Peter said. No one had said anything about babies, for God's sake. He dreamed of sharing an apartment with Kate someday, coming home to her each evening and telling her about his day, hearing about hers, going to bed naked with the covers pulled up to their chins, feeling her warm skin next to his when he woke up every morning. But that could only happen after he decided what to do with his life. George sighed.
I'll drive, he said. I'm sure she could use another set of hands. And I guess I should meet her, right?
Peter was nervous when they pulled up to Kate's dorm, jittery all the way down to his bones, like he was in the track van heading to States. Kate was wearing cutoffs, sneakers, clothes to lift and haul in. Her hair was piled at the top of her head, but he could see that she'd already sweat through the back of her T-shirt, a straight line down her spine. It was hot. And she'd schlepped a dozen boxes down from her dorm room, even though he told her to wait until he got there.
That her?
George said as they pulled up.
Remember, she's not expecting you, Peter said.
He could tell she hadn't spotted him yet, didn't know what kind of truck to look for. George was wearing black shorts, a tight black tank top that pulled at his belly, bright white sneakers. He checked his teeth in the mirror and then winked at Peter.
How does my hair look? He asked.
Peter watched Kate notice the man walking beside him.
George, she said when they got close enough. I'm so glad to meet you, she said.
She thanked him for coming, for lending both his truck and his muscle. George took her thanks in stride and was more reserved than usual, though Kate wouldn't know that. She asked if Peter had told him the details of the move they were about to embark on. George glanced at Peter.
East 79th, right? At 2nd?
Did he mention anything else? No? Great. Let's get going. It was a sixth-floor walk-up, was the thing neither of them had mentioned to George.
Jesus H. Christ, George said after the very first trip up the stairs, setting the first box down inside the apartment. You couldn't find a 12th floor walk-up?
You're fine, Kate said. Think of the powerful quads you'll have when we're through.
George grinned, and Peter felt the low-grade dread he'd been feeling since that morning begin to melt away. Every trip they made up those stairs, the closer George and Kate seemed to get. Up and down they went, and the stairwell rang out with Kate's voice chattering away, asking George questions about himself, what he thought about things, Monica Lewinsky, the Catholic Church, the Euro. They took a break when they were more than halfway through, and George told Kate the meaning of each of his tattoos. He told her about Rosaline, that he'd liked her for a long time before he asked her out. When they were finally finished moving up all the stuff, the three of them sprawled across Kate's new kitchen floor in exhausted silence. The apartment air felt stale. Already, Peter hated the idea of visiting Kate's life and having her visit his.
"Who wants a beer?" Kate asked, without making a move to stand up.
George said he'd pass. He had sodas in his truck. Peter got up, opened the door of the fridge, and let the cold air wrap around him for a moment before removing the six-pack Kate's roommates had left for them. He took one and downed it in two long sips before offering one to the others.
"Jeez," Kate said. "Leave some for the rest of us."
"Yeah, really," George said. When Peter and George returned to the truck, they found a cop hassling a delivery boy who had someone's takeout order dangling from the handlebar of his bike. The cop was huge, with arms so thick they strained the material of his uniform shirt.
"Excuse us," George said, stepping around them.
He double-parked, left the hazards on, and the cop looked over at George as if to let him know that he'd noticed and could do something about it if he wanted to. Once they were driving, George said that the problem with the cops today was that the job attracted a different kind of person than it used to. They still had great guys signing on.
"And women,"
he added. And one thing they did better than the old days was now they got people of every stripe and color. But there were too many young cops nowadays who were just after the power trip, carrying a gun. Maybe that's why they didn't get as much respect as they used to. In a just world, becoming a cop would be as prestigious a pursuit as becoming an investment banker, or a doctor even. Was there anything more important than keeping people safe? Being the one people turn to at their most desperate? And yet...
"You know what I saw the other day? On Broadway by the Bowling Green station? There were like 30 City College students protesting. One girl had a sign that said, 'Fuck the police.' Did you see that? It was the Monday of the week we were down at the Standard & Poor's building for that job. A white girl, a woman, I mean, probably came from New Canaan on the train that morning. Now you tell me what beef she might have with the police. You tell me who she's going to call if some man pulls out his junk on the crosstown bus."
Peter had seen the protesters, but hadn't really thought about them. He wasn't paying close enough attention, but George's point seemed both solid and completely flawed.
"But the history of policing is also a history of protest," Peter said. "I'm sure they were reacting to that cop who roughed up the kid in Bed-Stuy over the weekend. What was he, 13? They could have killed him."
13, but he looked older."
"And if he were older, he wasn't doing anything wrong."
"Peter," George looked at him, "I'm not denying that some cops are racist assholes. I'm saying now that girl from New Canaan decides that every cop is a racist asshole, just because some meathead in the 7-9 beat up a kid. He never should have gotten near a shield and a gun, that guy."
Peter laughed.
"Isn't that what every minority in this city has to deal with every single day? Whole groups being judged based on the actions of a few?"
But Peter was only half debating, since he was still thinking about Kate and the overcrowded apartment he was about to move into. The thought of four guys sharing the same small bathroom made him wonder why he'd agreed. George said he was willing to bet most of those protesters had never personally met and spoken to a cop.
"A big problem is the job doesn't pay enough," George said. "You listening? Not for the danger. And then another problem is first chance a good city cop gets, he or she heads to the suburbs. I read an article about it."
"About what?"
"About the police," Hello? Earth to Peter? Young people have to see it as a place where they can use their brains.
In the passenger seat, Peter sat up straight, felt a tug of such force it seemed impossible that it had come from within. It's an important job. George glanced at him.
That's what I'm saying.
That night, Kate no doubt long asleep in her new apartment, Peter lay awake and felt a world older than he had when he imagined college as a road that would bring him somewhere far away. Around midnight, he gave up on sleep, slid his feet into his weathered sneakers, slipped out of the apartment, and then outside into the drizzly dark. At the Banner, he acted as if he were new to the neighborhood. After his second drink, he asked the bartender if he remembered a guy from a few years ago, a tall guy, wavy hair, a cop. Used to be a regular before he moved down south.
You're describing everyone, the bartender said. Narrow it down.
Nah, it's nothing, Peter said, and waved him off. An hour later, when Peter set his glass down on the bar and reached for his wallet to fish out a few bills, he felt his hands tremble. Outside again, the drizzle now a downpour, he felt himself swimming toward the lure of the familiar, a path he could make his own and make right. He wondered if recruits got paid through academy. He wondered if the health insurance started immediately or only after several months' delay. He'd tell Kate as soon as he took the written exam. Then he told himself he'd tell her as soon as he found out whether he passed. He kept shaping for the ironworkers, kept getting per diem work. He tried to go for a run every day after work because it made him feel like he was still a student, and it kept him out of the apartment for an extra hour. Autumn came and went, Christmas. The evening news was in a lather over Y2K. The world had just a few more months to organize itself before the century changed and all files were lost. The subways would stop running. Planes would drop from the sky. All because programmers in the 1960s had not prepared for an existence beyond 1999. The new millennium arrived, and the world kept turning. In February, he heard from the applicant processing division that he'd passed the written test and that there was additional paperwork to be filled out. Among this paperwork was a form that consented to a background check. An investigator was assigned to his application. He sat for a character screening, a psychological screening, an oral test, the medical test. They checked his vision, hearing, blood pressure, his heart. When the doctor took his resting pulse, he said either Peter was a runner or he was dead. After all that came the formal interview, scheduled with the same investigator who had completed his background check. George figured it out when he saw the envelopes arriving. He told Peter it didn't feel like all that long ago that he'd brought in the mail and noticed similar envelopes for Brian. He asked Peter if he was sure, how far along he was in the process, how he'd done on the formal interview, if he'd met with anyone since the background check. That's the last step. Next week.
Ah. Okay.
George said, but seemed concerned.
What? Nothing.
The investigator introduced himself as a member of the Detective Bureau. He seemed jolly enough, and Peter could tell he was trying to put him at ease. He told Peter about the car trouble he'd had that morning, how his wife was a nag but was always right. Peter had shaved carefully, was wearing a sport coat and tie. All the other tests had taken place in Lafrak City, but this one was held on East 20th Street in Manhattan. Peter had a folder with him that contained every document they'd asked for, from his social security card to his transcript from Elliot. His backpack was too scuffed for him to use, and he didn't have a briefcase, so he clutched the folder in his hand on the subway, and all morning he was paranoid that something had slipped out and fluttered away without his noticing. He checked and rechecked. When he got to the building, a young woman directed him to the interview room and brought him a glass of water. When the investigator came in, he sat across from Peter at a beat-up wood table. The older man began with the questions Peter expected, the ones he'd practiced answering in his head on his evening runs, why Peter wanted to join and how he envisioned the job. He framed everything like a casual chat, like they were simply getting to know each other at a barbecue or a baseball game, though Peter could tell he was ticking through the items on his list. Finally, He asked about Peter's parents. And Peter gave the answer he'd rehearsed, the answer he'd been giving for years. His mother lived upstate. His father lived down south. They'd separated a decade ago, and Peter didn't have a relationship with either of them. He nodded quickly to indicate that was the extent of his answer, but the investigator tilted his head, leaned forward.
Your father, he was on the job, no?
Yes. Yes, he was.
19 years. Did he get injured? Something happen?
He flipped through his notes, and Peter felt his pulse firing in the palms of his hands. He knew it was possible that the man knew everything already, but he also knew it was possible the department was so vast, with so many moving parts, that it might have gotten missed. Nothing that happened in Gillam had happened on the job for Brian.
There was a personal matter that prompted an early retirement.
Oh? What was that?
He'd been warned that there was no limit to the scope of their questions. In the psychological exam, they asked him if he was seeing anyone, if that person was a man or a woman, how he would feel if his eventual partner were a woman, how about a gay man or a gay woman, how about black, Hispanic, Asian. He'd assumed those questions were illegal.
We're not close. We don't have a relationship.
That wasn't the question.
He retired early because he wanted a change. At least, I believe that's why. But you'd have to ask him, honestly. He moved down south when I was 15. I lived with my uncle after he left.
Your Uncle George Stanhope,
the investigator said, and Peter felt his stomach drop.
Yes.
And your mother, she lives on 6th Street in Saratoga now?
I don't know, Peter said. This, at least, was the truth.
She was arrested in 1991 and charged with attempted murder. The man she shot was a neighbor, an NYPD lieutenant off duty. She pleaded not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect. The case settled, correct?
Peter remained silent while his heart pounded.
I was 14. I wasn't privy to most of the details.
It was your father's off-duty weapon that she used, correct?
Yes, I believe so.
You believe so?
The investigator pushed his notes aside.
You aced the written test. You aced the physical. Your college transcript is solid.
Peter waited for the other shoe to drop.
But the psych exam raised a flag. I'm talking about your psych exam, Peter. Not your mother's, not your father's, yours.
Peter knew he might be testing him. The psych exam consisted of 1,000 questions over the course of 6 hours. At one point, he was asked to draw a house, a tree, himself. After, he remembered he'd forgotten to draw a doorknob on the front of the house. How would he get in through a door without a knob? As for the self-portrait, he'd drawn himself in shorts and a racing singlet, and afterward thought he should have drawn a suit and tie.
And your father's record with us is troubling. He has a citation for drinking on the job, January 1989.
I'm not my father. I don't even know him anymore.
And Uncle George has a sheet. Minor stuff, but worth mentioning.
Peter looked toward the narrow window and tried to gather his scattering thoughts.
I've never done a single thing wrong. I'm the one who's applying. Not my mother, not my father, not my uncle. So their histories don't matter. Only mine matters.
Maybe, the investigator said. That might be true. Depends.
He waited 2 weeks. A month. 6 weeks. He'd heard there was a new academy class starting up soon, and if his name didn't get added to the list of eligible recruits, he wouldn't be able to join. Kate was enjoying her job, despite the odd hours, despite the things she had to see when she was called out to crime scenes, down on her hands and knees with her blacklight, searching for fluid and blood.
"What's with you?" Kate asked.
They'd gone to see a movie, but the few times Kate looked over at him in the flickering dark, Peter wasn't looking at the screen. The movie wasn't even halfway through when he took her hand and pulled her down the aisle, out to the lobby, and then to the frigid air of the sidewalk outside.
When are we going to live together, Kate? When are we going to get married?
When are our lives going to be the way we agreed they were going to be, instead of just getting together two or three nights a week? I don't like it.
Kate laughed. They were standing 6 feet apart on a gum-flocked sidewalk. The woman sitting in the ticket booth was behind glass, reading a book.
I'm serious, don't you want to get married?
Well, I think you're supposed to ask me if I'm up for it.
I did, didn't I? About 10 years ago.
No, you told me it was going to happen. I don't think you asked. Plus, I was 13.
Well, are you up for it?
Of course I am, she said. But I hope you know this doesn't count as a proposal. And then, Peter, what in the world is wrong with you? He paced back and forth as he told her everything, starting with the night he decided to become a cop, all the way up to the formal interview and the long weeks he'd been waiting, wondering if he was going to get in. He was sorry he didn't tell her, but he wanted it to be a surprise. Kate watched and listened as she shivered and hugged herself tight. Because what would he do otherwise, was the question he kept coming back to. Now that he knew what he wanted to be, he was sure of it. There were so many different ways to be a cop, so many different trajectories. No two careers looked alike. It was insane that they could hold against him something that had happened so long ago, something that truly had nothing to do with him. He thought of calling up that investigator and asking for another interview. What did Kate think of that idea? Did he say anything more about whatever flags were raised in the psych exam? Did he give you details?
No, he probably made that up.
Kate nodded, and Peter could almost see all the information he'd just given her get sorted into compartments in her brain.
If I don't get in, I was thinking we could move. I could try Boston or somewhere in Connecticut, Hartford, Stamford. They probably don't have so many applicants, plus...
Peter, Kate said, unwrapping her arms from around herself and approaching him. He felt her body's warmth through her thick down coat. You're sure? She asked. You're certain this is what you want?
Yes, he said.
He'd be a better cop than his father had been. He'd be more like Francis Gleason before he got shot. He'd get to the place Francis would have landed had his career not been derailed. He'd be respectful, and he'd follow the rules, and he'd climb the ranks. He could see it already. Let me try one thing. Can you hang on a little while longer? What's the guy's name? The investigator, I mean. Kate took the early bus to Gillam that Sunday and walked home without calling for a pickup. She stopped walking when she was halfway down Jefferson and saw the windows of her childhood home were decorated with her and her sister's old heart cutouts for Valentine's Day. The thought of her mother unfolding the stairs to the attic and getting down the old decorations, while her father held the stairs steady and said, as he always did, "Be careful up there, Lena," made Kate want to drop to her knees and cry. She remembered her father coming home from a midnight tour one Valentine's Day and presenting each of them with heart-shaped erasers for their pencils. For Lena, he had a dozen roses, and as she trimmed the ends and fussed about finding a vase, she said he should have waited until late February when the markup wasn't so steep. She wasn't the kind of wife who would mind. Kate knocked softly at the front door, and when no one answered, she went around the side of the house, the frost-stiffened grass crunching under her sneakers, and got the hide a key from under the false rock. When she pushed open the back door, her father was already opening the cabinet to remove a second mug. "I saw you coming," he said. "Where's Mom?"
"Sleeping."
It was not quite 8 o'clock. Lena's hair had grown back, curls as full as ever, only she didn't bother coloring it anymore, so it was threaded with steel and white. Her cancer had been in remission for several years. She never discussed what had happened between Francis and Joan Kavanaugh, but Kate was with her once, about a year after her surgery, her hair still impish and short, when they were walking through the parking lot of an Italian restaurant back to Lena's car, and Lena stopped all of a sudden, turned back to the restaurant. "I forgot something," she called over her shoulder. Kate almost laughed at the abruptness of it until she saw Joan Kavanaugh walking through the parking lot across the street. Only when Joan had entered a shop on the other side did Lena reemerge.
Mom, Kate had said, once they were seated in the car.
I just don't like seeing her, Lena said. I feel embarrassed for some reason.
You have no reason to feel embarrassed. She should be embarrassed.
Still, she shrugged.
Mom sleeps later than she did when you girls were young,
Francis said now. All of Kate's life, he seemed to always know when there was something on her mind. She put her bag down by the door and took the mug he offered. He passed the milk in silence.
Just felt like a visit, he said.
He folded his newspaper into quarters. He was already dressed, had been to the deli. He had an empty sheet of wax paper in front of him, another wrapped around a buttered roll on the counter, waiting for Lena.
Yeah, haven't been home in a little while.
Well, you're busy. How's work?
He knew, she realized. She didn't know how, but he did. She listened for her mother's footsteps on the stairs, but the house was silent. The space heater hummed lightly in the corner by the stove.
I need to ask you a favor, she said.
Oh?
Peter is applying to the police academy.
Francis was silent for a beat.
Peter Stanhope?
Yes, that Peter.
Francis studied her with a blank expression.
Anyway, he hasn't heard whether he's eligible yet, but it's been longer than usual, and a few things came up in his interview.
And in his psych exam,
Francis said. Kate felt every part of her body go still.
Did he tell you that?
Yes, of course he told me, but they may have only said that to rattle him.
No, it's true. A few little things, minor. But combined with his family history, it's troubling.
How do you know all this?
I have a friend. He called to let me know, asked what I thought.
Kate stared at him over her tea.
What did you say?
Is that the favor?
To put a good word in for him?
Yes.
Why?
Because he wants to be a police officer and he'd be a very good one. And because I love him and one day, probably pretty soon, we're going to get married.
Finally, Francis sighed, pushed back from the table.
You're throwing your life away, he said.
She put down her mug just as neatly as he had and pointed out that it was her life. Besides, was he in a position to lecture about throwing one's life away? It was only because of Lena's forgiving nature that he was even sitting there right now in front of her. Francis let that pass over him.
You think a person comes out of a house like that undamaged? You don't see it now, Kate, but it's there. I promise you. Marriage is long. All the seams get tested.
Well, you would know, right? Kate said.
Francis gave her a warning look. She looked right back.
Why him?
Because I love him.
Love isn't enough. Not even close.
It is for me. Him too.
Francis smiled, but there was no light in it.
You don't have the first clue what you're talking about.
Kate stayed exactly where she was and tried not to react. How dare he, of all people, tell her what love was? Along the windowsill was a row of jam jars stuffed with dirt and seedlings. Francis stood, and Kate saw that his jeans hung from his hips. Even his shoulders seemed narrower than they used to. He had crumbs down the front of his shirt. She wondered, as she did once in a great while, why he'd never returned to Ireland, why he'd never brought them there, how it was possible he'd lived a whole life before she was even born. She'd always felt sort of sad for him, leaving his parents forever when he was still so young, but now she saw how much freedom that had given him, with no one hovering on the sidelines telling him what to do.
You can be against it, Dad, but it's happening. I love him. You can be a part of our lives or not, it's up to you. He can stay on with the ironworkers, or he can go to law school, or he can do something else. He wants to be a cop, but the truth is, I don't care if he ends up digging dishes.
Francis sighed. He got the ice tray out of the fridge and cracked it by twisting. One by one, he removed cubes and dropped them into the jam jars. When he finished, he remained facing the window.
I told them to go ahead and put him on the list for the next class. I told them he was a good boy, a good student, though his parents were trouble. I told them I had no problem with it.
Kate stood so quickly that her chair tipped backward and clattered to the floor.
I told them none of it was his fault, what happened that night. I told them that he'd gone on to do well in school and all that. What you told me that time, when Mom was in surgery, running and getting a scholarship, they already knew that, of course.
So you forgive him, then? You don't blame him?
She wanted to throw her arms around him like she was 10 again.
You don't blame me?
Francis turned. I never blamed him. He was 14 years old. Why would I blame him? And why in the world would I blame you? You're not understanding the problem here. You're not even near understanding it.
But it was he who wasn't understanding, Kate knew. All would be well now. They had gone through a bad time, the Gleasons, the Stanhopes. But now look at them. Look at the funny way life could go. Immediately, Kate pictured Peter on Jefferson Street for Thanksgiving, Christmas, all the holidays, sitting between her sisters on the couch, getting up to make them another pot of coffee, pulling gifts from under the tree and calling out the names. George too, maybe. Rosaline. Look at the happy ending that could come out of a terrible thing. Theirs was a story for the ages, star-crossed, but without the tragic ending, without the fatalities.
I still worry about her, Francis said. Your mother does too. Now that she's living on her own, we don't get updates.
You mean Peter's mother? He doesn't even see her. He never talks about her. She doesn't matter anymore.
Doesn't matter?
Katie.
Love. She's the person who made him. She's always going to matter.
At that, Kate turned away from the memory of the woman framed in the door of the Dunkin' Donuts restroom on Halloween, her face pale and gaunt, the expression in her eyes wild. She turned away from the other glimpses she'd had since then. Anne Stanhope sitting in a car on 103rd Street, engine off, a cup of pistachio shells on her lap. Kate had pulled up her hood as she passed and walked quickly by Peter's building, calling instead from the Thai restaurant 2 blocks away, asking him to meet her there. Another time in Riverside Park, where Peter liked to run, standing next to a tree in a bulky coat that was far too broad in the shoulders for her, Kate had noticed her just before Peter arrived at their appointed spot, his sweaty skin steaming lightly in the cold air.
You okay? He'd asked that day.
I'm fine, Kate had said, glancing over her shoulder, and then taking hold of his arm, leading him down to the river to point out the faint Christmas lights all the way over in New Jersey. Here was a woman who'd wanted to hurt her, a woman who had hurt her father so badly that the father Kate remembered from when she was a little girl had disappeared, and in his place came a new father, a man she often struggled to recognize. And he'd never returned, that first father. She waited and waited, but he never came back after that, not completely, and that was Anne Stanhope's fault. Kate should be afraid of the woman. She knew she should be, and yet she wasn't. At least not the way her father meant. And the most recent time, near Kate's apartment, Peter all the way across town. Anne was sitting on a bench outside the Hungarian bakery, scowling at the passers-by. Her eyes lifted when Kate arrived at the opposite corner, as if sensing her there. Kate was beginning to turn back, beginning to flee, but she decided, no, I will not flee, and instead felt something like rage rise up in her throat. 4 lanes of traffic divided them, 2 northbound, 2 south, and Kate began to cross before the light turned. She held up her arms to stop traffic and knew what Moses felt like when he stopped the waves from crashing over him. When Anne stood from her bench, Kate felt her courage falter, but she jutted out her jaw and kept moving. She stretched her body as tall as she could to make herself seem bigger, just like her father had done that night when he strode up to their door. The sunshine was bitter cold, and trapped in the gutter ice were cigarette butts, candy wrappers, a pen. "What do you want?" Kate asked, when she was close enough for Anne to hear. The subway entrance was just a few paces away. Whenever she needed to, she could disappear down there, reemerge somewhere far downtown, pretend to herself and to Peter that this encounter had never taken place. She'd take a cab back home
and she'd avoid this corner for a week.
"I want to talk with Peter," Anne said. "I thought you could help me."
"Me? You want me to help you?" Kate laughed. But it came out clotted and choked. "You have some nerve, you know that?"
Kate took a step closer to Anne.
"Stay away from him," Kate said, her voice a low growl. "And stay away from me. He doesn't want to see you."
Anne took a breath, as if to speak, but Kate was already gone, crossing traffic against the light once again. Muster. 15. What had been done to Anne at 12 by their neighbor, Mr. Kilcoyne, kept being done until she turned 16 and left for England. He'd show up with a fistful of ribbons or a dress that needed mending and ask if she could come help with the little girls. He was hopeless with bows and plaits, he said. Mrs. Kilcoyne had died of a stomach ailment the same year Anne's own mother had walked into the rough water at Killiney Beach with all her clothes on, her shoes, 3 days before Christmas in the year 1964. She left a mother-of-pearl brooch and a few pound notes on the mantel. That first time, Mr. Kilcoyne came for her. Once they got just past the stone that marked Kilcoyne Land, Mr. Kilcoyne said,
"Wait there just a minute, Anne,"
and then clutched her by the shoulder and by the hip, pulling her up against him hard. It was a bit like a hug, except Anne didn't hug back, and he was trembling, clutching her tighter and tighter as the trembling became more violent. Something was happening to him under his clothes.
"The girls will be waiting for us," Anne said when he finally let her go. And in her bewilderment, she felt dazed, lightheaded, though what had happened, maybe nothing. She strode through a thicket of nettles and her shins went afire. When she got to England, she made a friend called Bridget, and after a while told her about Mr. Kilcoyne, how it had begun, and how he'd graduated from clutching her over her clothes to asking her to follow him into the hay shed.
"But Anne, why'd you go? Could you not think of any reason not to?" Bridget asked. "There was a man had a shop at home who was like your Mr. Kilcoyne, and I always told him my mother was expecting me, that she'd come round looking for me any minute, and then I'd run off."
They were sitting on a low wall in a schoolyard on the outskirts of London, both assistants at the hospital, both Irish and living with a group of other Irish girls they found through an ad in the newspaper.
"Why did I go?" Anne wondered. It was a good question, and one, even more than 40 years on, she couldn't answer. Once, she almost sent her sister, younger than Anne by 1 year, but older seeming than Anne in some ways, and Anne had heard in the schoolyard that she had a fella. Mr. Kilcoyne had come to the door as always, but instead of pulling on her cardigan right away, she said she wasn't feeling well.
"Bernadette can go," she said.
Her father turned the radio down and rubbed his wiry brows. Bernadette looked up from picking her fingernails in surprise. Like a school pantomime, everything stopped for a beat of one or two breaths. But then, before Bernadette or Mr. Kilcoyne could even respond, Anne continued. "But the girls are used to me now," she said. Always, when she returned home, her father would ask after the Kilcoyne daughters, two of them still in nappies when it all began. Bernadette would have made the tea and would be sitting in the corner, hopping her foot, waiting for time to pass. She almost told them once, the first time Mr. Kilcoyne put his hand under her clothes, his cold hand that had delivered a calf that morning. But her father was taking his tea and listening to the radio, and next thing she knew, he was packing his pipe and heading out again. Watching him cross the small yard to the path by the cowshed, she knew that even if she told him, nothing would change, except then it would be in the air between them, undiscussed, just like her mother's death. Bernadette went flying outside to visit with her schoolmate, who was passing on the low road. Anne regretted telling Bridget almost immediately. Telling her, bringing that story to England, spoiled England for her. When she left for America 2 years later, she knew she would be smarter. She'd bring none of Ireland with her.
She'd start the training program in New York City, and she'd buy a few new blouses, and she'd get her hair cut like Jackie Kennedy, and she'd never even think about Ireland again. But she'd learned a thing or two from all those years of being made to sit in rooms with doctors, first in the nice hospital, and then in the one that was less nice. She'd learned that the beginning of one's life mattered the most, that life was top-heavy in that way. Why else would the doctors keep asking about it, when the events that had gotten her locked in a hospital had happened so much more recently? She'd turned her back on Ireland the day she left, but it was still there, behind her, like a shadow that followed her from place to place to place. The body that had driven several hours south along the New York State Thruway to see a son she hadn't spoken to in so many years was the same body that cut through the tall grass of St. Dymphna's in 1967. It was the same body that pushed out two baby boys, the same body that made itself stiff as a plank when Mr. Kilcoyne breathed too close to her ear. The beginning mattered for Peter, too, whether he knew that yet or not. All those years of moving carefully around the house in Gillam had made an imprint on him, somewhere. There were some months when Anne would drive the 4 hours downstate to check up on Peter as many as 3 times, staying 6 or 8 or even 12 hours at a stretch. She'd turn on the radio while she waited to glimpse him, listen to a celebrity interview or instructions on how to brine a turkey, or how to save herself if she were to ever find her car submerged in water. On those trips, if the weather was especially nice, she'd stop at the lookout on the Palisades and sit on a bench, gazing at the broad Hudson. Often, when her mind was so full of Peter that she needed a break from thinking about him, she'd force herself to change the subject, like an engine releasing a bit of steam, and instead, she'd imagine the wilderness on either side of the river as it had once been. She'd imagine what it must have been like for Henry Hudson, how terrifying and how thrilling and, ultimately, how frustrating. The thing was, sometimes 400 years seemed like an impossibly huge amount of time to fathom, and sometimes it seemed like nothing at all. A patient at the nursing home, a man who used to work at the college, once told her about humanity's common ancestor, a woman named Lucy who lived over 3 million years ago. Compared to Lucy, Henry Hudson had navigated the North River for the first time only yesterday. Compared to Henry Hudson's first voyage upriver, Anne had last lived in a house with Peter only a second ago. Less. There were some months when she didn't go to see him at all, and instead told herself that she'd seen what she'd wanted to see. He was healthy, he was happy, and now it was time to leave him alone. She told herself that just knowing where he was would have to be enough for her. But whenever a few months went by, the same aimless impatience welled up that she'd felt all those years ago in Gillam. Kate Gleason had been nothing but a regular suburban girl, like a million others. Was she especially beautiful? No. Was she particularly smart? Anne doubted it. So what was it then? When she dwelled on the question too much, her internal gears began turning more quickly. He could have gone to a better college. He could have become a doctor or a senator. And then she'd point to him and look back to her life in Ireland, and she'd be able to measure a great distance. But to come all the way here and raise a child who became a cop, how Irish, how typical. And fall in love with any old girl? What was the point? When she thought too much about all of this, she wouldn't be able to sleep for staring at the ceiling. Used to be, at the very least, she could make Peter stay inside their house if she didn't want him seeing Kate. And now here was Kate, arms crossed, always standing between them. She tried to let it go, to breathe in and out and let the information go still inside her brain. But there was a twist in Kate that Peter didn't see. Her face, livid and red outside the Hungarian bakery on Lexington that morning, was like the shedding of a mask, and Anne thought, yes, exactly, this is what you're really like. But that was the story with men and women since the beginning of time. They never saw each other clearly until it was too late. And yet, even as she thought those things, she also thought there was something to admire in the way Kate had come striding directly at her, the way she'd looked right into her face and told her to stay away. She loves him, Anne saw that day. She loves him more than whatever else she has in her life. And she's fierce. There might be more to her than Anne had credited. If she didn't have the courage to approach Peter, to try to connect with him again, then what was the point of watching him like a stalker? She knew that was the question, and she didn't need Dr. Oliver to be the one to ask. The crazy thing was that Kate almost always saw her. It was as if she knew when Anne was out there, and looked around for her as soon as she stepped through the door. Of course, it was possible that she went through every day with the same hunted expression she wore when Anne was watching, but it always felt to Anne like she knew. They moved in together, to a dingy ground-floor apartment in Alphabet City. She lost track of them for a few months, but then the detective found them. Anne looked in the barred window one afternoon when neither of them were home, and saw dishes in the sink, a pile of empty bottles in a bin by the door, a pair of cereal boxes on the counter. She hadn't been down in several weeks when September 11th, 2001 arrived. According to the news, there was no point in driving down right away because she wouldn't be able to get near him, not by car, not by public transportation. So instead, she watched the television she'd finally purchased and searched for his face in the footage of police officers trying to make sense of the chaos. He wasn't dead. If he were dead, she was certain she'd know. Still, she wanted to hear his voice. So, every few hours, she went down to the payphone on Perry Street, and using a prepaid card, she dialed his number, a landline, but it just kept ringing. Finally, on September 13th, he answered. "Peter?" she said, when he said hello. "Yes," he said, after the slightest hesitation. He sounded tired. He waited and waited and waited. "Don't go down there," she wanted to say. "Leave it for other people." There were stories of rubble sliding, of objects falling from great heights. She could hear him breathing on the other end of the line when she hung up. About a year after they moved in together, Anne saw Kate coming around the corner with dry cleaning slung over her shoulder when she ran into a woman she seemed to know, showed that woman her hand. Where a moment before she'd seemed so serious, now she looked radiant, and nodded to accept whatever the other woman was saying to her while the dry cleaning bags brushed the filthy sidewalk. She was still smiling into the collar of her coat as she fished out the keys to her building. Next thing, Peter jogged up, began to move more stealthily when he realized Kate hadn't seen him. He crept up behind her and grabbed her by the waist. Anne's heart clutched inside her chest. Married, Anne knew. She tried to get a good look at him, at his left hand, as if looking closely might give her the details she craved. Had the Gleasons all been there? George? Had they had a big party? In the early morning, Peter came outside alone. She could always tell when he hadn't worked in a few days because his beard came in thick and sudden, just like Brian's used to. She followed him to the park, where he did a few half-hearted pull-ups and then quit, sat on the cold tarmac, then lay flat, arms and legs thrown wide. He'd grown a little thicker in the years that had passed since she first saw him that Halloween night. He squinted at the sky and after a while closed his eyes as his breath rose straight up from his mouth in plumes. She hadn't seen him coming back from a run in a long time. Kate worked odd hours, whatever she did. She used to commute to Queens, but now she took the subway to 26th Street. Peter's hours shifted weekly, too, and sometimes he was just coming home as Kate was leaving, and they'd pause at the security door of their building to hug each other, talk about things that Anne couldn't hear. They moved out of that apartment in 2004. She sensed something was brewing, something about the way they rushed around and conferred outside the building, and then the next several times she came down, she didn't see them at all. Finally, she worked up the courage to peek in their window once again, but drew back quickly when she met eyes with a stout, middle-aged man cooking something in a pan, not wearing a shirt. The man came to the window. "See something you like?" Anne stood her ground. "Wasn't there someone else who used to live here?" He laughed.
There probably was, yes, but now I live here.
He looked her up and down.
You want to come in?
Anne hurried away.
The private detective she'd enlisted all those years before was no longer in business, so she had to find another. He got her the address in Floral Park and a photo of a little Tudor that looked like a gingerbread house. He also confirmed they were married. They'd only put 10% down on the house.
What's the block like? The neighborhood?
It had come as a shock, this change. Though she supposed when she thought about it that she hadn't expected them to live in that grim apartment forever.
The detective shrugged.
What do you want to know?
I don't know, Anne said. She stayed away for months and months, but studied Floral Park on a map, memorized the route she'd have to take. The year 2005 arrived, and she was still trying and failing to imagine him in a house that was not their house in Gillam. Finally, she drove 3 hours down to the city, over a bridge, and then out to Long Island. As she read the signs, she remembered that she'd once been to a beach on Long Island, years earlier, with Brian, before they were married, maybe their second or third date. She'd forgotten all about it, and then all of a sudden she could see Brian sitting on the sand and telling her to go swim. He'd stay with their stuff so no one would take it. In America, in New York, he said, someone always has to hang back and stand guard. It was a very small but sweet house, snow on the eaves and the tops of all the bushes, warm yellow light inside. The driveway was pitted and cracked. She looked around at all the things her son must look at when he stepped out the door in the mornings. Anne turned off the engine and watched for signs of Peter, as if she might spot his old bike outside. After not very long, she saw Kate pass by a ground floor window, the blinds open, the lights inside illuminating her as clearly as if she were on a stage. Tidying up, it seemed, laundry in her arms. She passed by the window again, and Anne realized that what Kate was holding in her arms, pressing to her chest, was not a pile of laundry, but a baby. It took a beat to put it together. Peter's baby, too. She got out of the car and stood in a place where she was well shadowed. There they were again. Kate Gleason and Anne's own baby grandchild. A brand new person, made out of nothing. Anne remembered Peter as a baby, how quickly he transformed. For so long he could barely move at all, and then one day he pulled himself up to standing. Another day he walked. Another day he seemed to already know all the words he'd ever need to know in a life. A few cars passed, and with each one Anne leaned away from the sweep of the headlights and vowed that if Peter came home right then, she would approach him. It was even more important now. She thought of her father for the first time in years. He'd been dead and gone since before Peter was born, but this small person living in a place called Long Island, United States of America, wouldn't exist if Anne hadn't existed, and her parents before her, so on and so forth until the beginning of time. She thought of her father's muck-caked boots, him spitting outside in the yard. She thought of the small threads of tobacco that used to rain down around him at the table, how they'd stain the floor if she didn't sweep them up quickly enough. She thought about how lonely he and Bernadette must have been when Anne left for England, announcing her plan on a Thursday and gone by Saturday morning. She thought of her mother, about how much of her, too, might be contained within that small body. Suddenly, she went cold with worry. But none of the cars were Peter's, and no one came outside. And eventually, the sky became streaked with morning. When she left Floral Park after finding out about the baby, it was with a plan to return in no time at all. She was no longer required to see Dr. Oliver. She could get a job somewhere near them. She could stop by and mind the child for an hour if Kate wanted to get to the store. She thought about how little was in her apartment, how she could pack it up in a single hour if she wanted to. And yet, as soon as she parked her car, walked up the stairs to her apartment, opened the door and sat down on the edge of her bed, she knew that Kate would never let her mind that baby, her grandchild. and in a moment of perfect stillness, Anne couldn't blame her. Where an hour earlier she had a mind to stop by her apartment only long enough to pack up and drive right back down to them, now she saw that the baby would make it more difficult. She knew time was passing, of course she did, but she thought at some point, when the moment was perfect, she'd eventually step back into his life and pick up where they left off. He was married, yes, but only to Kate Gleason. But now there was a baby, which meant he was further along in his life than she'd understood. She calculated. He was 28 already. There'd be more children after this one, probably. What was painful before would now be unbearable. She drove down to Floral Park every few months, but only once did she glimpse Peter, and that glimpse was so brief it barely counted. Their garage door opened, and he appeared. He grabbed hold of the garbage can and carried it down the driveway to the curb. He seemed tired, worried. He looked up at the roof line of the house. He rubbed his eyes. Then he plunged his hand into his pocket, fished out a set of keys, slipped into his car, and drove away, leaving the garage door wide open. Her child, in this grown man's body. She clutched the steering wheel so tightly that her fingers hurt when she let go. Otherwise, it was only Kate, she glimpsed. Kate with that baby who turned into a toddler, a boy, brown curls, wriggly in her arms. Then, not terribly long after that boy began taking steps, there was Kate rushing to the car with another baby in her arms. Even when there were two cars in the driveway, and Anne thought, surely, he was in there somewhere. All Anne glimpsed, time after time after time, was Kate moving through lighted rooms, saying things that Anne couldn't hear. "Those babies are my grandchildren," she'd say aloud, over and over. Where before she used to leave feeling sad, but somewhat reassured, he was doing okay, after all. He had a job, even if he was a cop. He had a partner, even if that partner was Kate Gleason. Since that first baby was born, she felt unsettled. Twice she spotted George, though he looked different, and it wasn't until the second time that she figured out who he was. He appeared taller than he used to, and younger than he should be, though that wasn't possible, was it? The way he carried himself down their front path told Anne he'd been there more times than he could count. It was too much to think about, and so she found things to do up in Saratoga to keep herself away. She volunteered at the food bank every week. She walked dogs around town for people who were on vacation. She tried reading stories to kids at the library, but they all seemed so needy, more interested in telling her stories about themselves and their pets and their brothers and grandpas than listening to the story she read. She kept track of the ages of her grandchildren, though she didn't know their birthdays. Whenever she saw them for the first time after not seeing them for several months, it was as if they'd transformed. A few times she felt too tired to drive all the way back upstate, so she stayed at a motor lodge on Jericho Turnpike. She glimpsed Peter driving toward her one morning as she was heading toward his house. The sun was in his eyes. Who did the children look like? Not Peter, really. Not Kate. The older one looked to be about 8 already, the girl maybe 6. In the spring they shed their layers like skins, leaving jackets and sweatshirts thrown over bushes and on the steps. In the warm months they turned on the sprinkler in the side yard and played in their bathing suits with some kids Anne recognized from up the street. Had they met their other grandparents? She wondered. Of course they had. What word did they use for Lena Gleason? She wondered if Peter and Kate ever mentioned her. She could already imagine the story they might tell about that one terrible night. Or maybe they would take the easy route and simply tell them she was dead. Each time she pulled up to the curb and turned off the car, she decided the moment had come. That finally, after so many years, she was going to walk up and ring the doorbell and say she was sorry for everything and it was time to know each other again. She'd think and debate with herself about the best way to do it, and then she'd decide, next time. Again, and again, and again. Next time. And then, late June 2016, the smell of a thunderstorm followed her all the way to their street. She parked several houses past theirs, as usual, nearly hidden by the weeping branches of their neighbor's tree, the rearview mirror tilted to show their front door. It was dusk. She did a quick calculation, as she always did when she first pulled up. Peter was 39, Kate was still 38 for several more weeks. Anne turned the radio on low and unwrapped her sandwich and settled in to watch the house while she still had the light. When it was fully dark, she took a short walk to stretch her legs and get closer, pulling up the hood of her light summer sweater in case they should come outside. She looked at their cars and their flower bed and their beach towels slung over the railing of their deck to dry. He was in there. His car was parked in the driveway, Kate's behind it. Lights approached from the main road, and Anne picked up her pace, dropped her chin to her chest, and turned away. The car slowed outside Peter's house, and Anne waited until she was well out of sight before crouching to pretend to tie her shoelace. It could be him, maybe, someone dropping him off. But when she looked over her shoulder, it was not Peter she spotted, but another familiar person, a man, though it took her a few seconds to place him. "Francis Gleason," she whispered to the cicadas,